"We'll go on to the Algarian stronghold," King Rodar decided, as the army poured down out of the last pass and fanned out across the rolling grasslands. "We need to regroup a bit, and I don't see any point in moving to the base of the escarpment until the engineers are ready for us. Besides, I prefer not to announce the size of our army to any Tull who happens to glance down from the top of the cliff."
And so, in easy stages, the army marched across Algeria, trampling a mile-wide swath through the tall grass. Vast herds of cattle paused briefly in their grazing to watch with mild-eyed astonishment as the horde marched by, then returned to their feeding under the protective watch of mounted Algar clansmen. The encampment that was set up around the towering stronghold in south-central Algeria stretched for miles, and the watchfires at night seemed almost a reflection of the stars. Once she was comfortably quartered in the stronghold, Princess Tenedra found herself even more removed from the day-to-day command of her troops. Her hours seemed filled with tedium. It's not to say that she did not receive reports. A rigorous schedule of training was instituted, in part because large portions of the army were not professional soldiers, but primarily to avoid the idleness that led to discipline problems. Each morning, Colonel Brendig, the sober-faced Sindarin baronet, who seemed utterly devoid of humor, reported the progress of the previous day's training with excruciating thoroughness, along with all sorts of other tedious little details, most of which Tenedra found extremely distasteful. One morning, after Brendig had respectfully withdrawn, Tenedra finally exploded.
"If he mentions the word sanitation one more time, I think I'm going to scream," she declared to Adara and Polgara.
The princess was pacing up and down, flinging her arms in the air in exasperation.
"It is very important in an army of this size, Tenedra," Adara calmly pointed out. "But does he have to talk about it all the time? It's a disgusting subject."
Polgara, who had been patiently teaching the little blonde waif Erand how to lace up his boots, looked up, assessed Tenedra's mood in a single glance, and then made a suggestion.
"Why don't you young ladies take some horses and go for a ride? A bit of fresh air and exercise seems definitely to be in order."
It took only a short while for them to find the blonde Mimbrite girl, Ariana. They knew exactly where to look. It took a bit longer, however, to wrench her away from her rapt contemplation of Leldoran of Wildendor. Leldoran, with the aid of his cousin Torresen, was struggling to teach a group of Erendish serfs the basics of archery. Torresen, a fiery young Astorian patriot, had joined the army late. There had been, Tenedra gathered, some unpleasantness between two young men, but the prospect of war and glory had finally been too much for Torresen to resist. He had overtaken the army in the western foothills of Ugaland, mounted on a horse half dead from hard riding. His reconciliation with Leldoran had been emotional, and now the two were closer than ever. Ariana, however, watched only Leldoran. Her eyes glowed as she gazed at him with an adoration so totally mindless that it was frightening. The three girls, dressed in soft leather Algar riding clothes, cantered out through the encampment in bright mid-morning sunlight, followed inevitably by Olban, youngest son of the Riven Warder, and a detachment of guards. Tenedra did not know exactly what to make of Olban, since a hidden Murgo had made an attempt on her life in the Arendish forest. The young Riven had appointed himself the chief of her personal bodyguards, and absolutely nothing could move him to abandon the duty. For some reason, he seemed almost grateful for the opportunity to serve, and Tenedra was glumly certain that only physical force could make him stop. It was a warm, cloudless day, and the blue sky stretched over the incredible expanse of the Algarian plain, where tall grass bent before a vagrant breeze. Once they were out of sight of the encampment, Tenedra's spirits rose enormously. She rode the white horse King Kohag had given her, a patient, even-tempered animal she had named Noble. Noble was probably not a good name for him, since he was a lazy horse. A great part of his placidity arose from the fact that his new owner was so tiny that she had virtually no weight,
Moreover, in an excess of affection, Tenedra babied him outrageously, slipping apples and bits of sweets to him whenever possible. As a result of his light exercise and rich diet, Noble was developing a noticeable portliness. In the company of her two friends, and trailed by the watchful young Ulban, the princess, mounted on her stout white horse, rode out across the grassland, exulting in the sense of freedom their ride brought to her. They reined in at the base of a long, sloping hill to rest their mounts. Noble, puffing like a bellows, cast a reproachful look over his shoulder at his tiny mistress, but she heartlessly ignored his unspoken complaint.
"It is an absolutely wonderful day for a ride,"
she exclaimed enthusiastically. Eriana sighed. Tenedra laughed at her.
"Oh, come now. It's not as if Leldoran were going someplace, Eriana, and it is good for men to miss us a little once in a while."
Eriana smiled rather wanly, then sighed again.
"Perhaps it is not as good for us to miss them, however,"
Adara murmured, without any trace of a smile.
"Oh, what is that lovely fragrance?"
Tenedra asked suddenly. Adara lifted her porcelain face to sniff at the light breeze, then suddenly looked around as if trying to pinpoint their exact location.
"Come with me,"
she said, with an uncharacteristic note of command in her voice, and she led them around the base of the hill to the far side. About halfway up the grassy slope there was a patch of low, dark green bushes covered with pale lavender flowers. There had been that morning a hatch of blue butterflies, and the winged creatures hovered in ecstatic clouds over the flowers. Without pausing, Adara pressed her mount up the slope and swung down from her saddle. There, with a low cry, she knelt almost reverently, gathering the bushes in her arms as if embracing them. When Tenedra drew closer, she was amazed to see tears welling up in her gentle friend's gray eyes, although Adara was actually smiling.
"Whatever is wrong, Adara?" "They're my flowers,"
Adara replied in a vibrant voice.
"I did not realize that they grow and spread this way." "What are you talking about?" "Geryon created this flower last winter, just for me. There was only one, just one. I saw it come into existence right there in his hand. I had forgotten until just now. Look how far it spread in just one season."
Tenedra felt a sudden pang of jealousy. Geryon had never created a flower for her. She bent and pulled one of the lavender blooms from a bush, tugging perhaps just a bit harder than necessary.
"It is lopsided,"
she sniffed, looking at the flower critically. Then she bit her lip, wishing she had not said that. Adara gave her a quick look of protest.
"Oh, I am only teasing, Adara,"
Tenedra said quickly with a false little laugh. In spite of herself, still wanting to find something else wrong with the flower, she bent her face to the small crooked blossom in her hand. Its fragrance seemed to erase all of her cares and to lift her spirits tremendously. Eriana had also dismounted, and she too was breathing in the gentle odor of the flowers, although there was a slight frown on her face.
"May I gather some few of the blossoms, Lady Adara?"
she inquired.
"Methinks they have some strange property concealed within their blushing petals that may be of some interest to Lady Polgra. Some healing agent to settle for my limited familiarity with unguents and aromatic herbs to discern."
Rather predictably, Tenedra, having gone one way, suddenly reversed herself.
"Marvelous!"
she exclaimed, clapping her hands with delight.
"Would it not be wonderful if your flower turned out to be a great medicine, Adara? Some miraculous cure? We could call it Adara's Rose, and sick men would bless your name forever." "It doesn't exactly look like a rose, Tenedra,"
Adara pointed out.
"Nonsense!"
Tenedra brushed the distinction aside.
"I am supposed to be queen, after all. So, if I say it's a rose, then it's a rose, and that is that. We'll take the flowers back to Lady Polgra at once."
She turned back to her tubby horse, who was lazily regarding the flowers,
as if wondering whether or not to eat a few of them.
"Come, noble,"
the princess said to him with extravagant overstatement.
"We'll gallop back to the stronghold."
Noble winced visibly at the word gallop. Pulgra examined the flowers carefully, but to the disappointment of the princess and her friends, she would not commit herself immediately concerning their medicinal value. A bit subdued, the little princess returned quietly to her quarters and her duties. Colonel Brendig was awaiting her. Upon reflection, Zinedra concluded that Colonel Brendig was by far the most practical man she had ever met. No detail was too small for him. In a lesser man, such concern with little things might have been passed off as mere fussiness, but the colonel's belief that big things were made up of little things gave his patient attention to detail a certain dignity. He seemed to be everywhere in the camp. In his wake, tent ropes were tightened, cluttered heaps of equipment were arranged into neat stacks, and casually opened doublets were quickly buttoned up.
"I hope that Her Majesty found her ride refreshing," the colonel said politely, bowing as Tenedra entered the room.
"Thank you, Colonel Brendig,"
the princess replied.
"My Majesty did."
She was in a whimsical frame of mind, and it was always a delight to tease this sober-faced cinder. A brief smile touched Brendig's lips, and then he immediately got down to the business of the midday report.
"I'm pleased to advise Your Majesty that the Drasnian engineers have nearly completed the hoist atop the escarpment. All that remains is the rigging of the counterweights, which will help to lift the Kerak warships."
"That's nice,"
Zinedra said, with the vacant, empty-headed smile she knew drove him absolutely wild. Brendig's jaw tightened slightly, but his face betrayed no other sign of his momentary flash of irritation.
"The Keraks are beginning to remove the masts and rigging from their ships in preparation for the portage, and the fortified positions up on top of the escarpment are several days ahead of schedule."
"How wonderful,"
Zinedra exclaimed, clapping her hands with a great show of girlish delight.
"Your Majesty, please," Brendig complained.
"I'm sorry, Colonel Brendig,"
Zinedra apologized, affectionately patting his hand.
"For some reason, you bring out the very worst in me. Don't you ever smile?"
He looked at her with an absolutely straight face.
"I am smiling, Your Majesty." "Oh, you have a visitor from Tolnedra."
"A visitor? Who?"
"A General Varana, the Duke of Anadel."
"Varana? Here? What on earth is he doing in Okaria? Is he alone?"
"There are a number of other Tolnedran gentlemen with him," Brendig replied. "They're not in uniform, but they have the general bearing of military men. They say that they are here as private observers. General Varana expressed a desire to pay his respects whenever it might be convenient."
"Of course, Colonel Brendig,"
Zinedra said, with an enthusiasm that was no longer feigned.
"Please, send for him at once."
Zinedra had known General Varana since her earliest childhood. He was a stocky man with a graying, curly hair and a stiff left knee that gave him a noticeable limp. He was blessed with that wry, understated sense of humor, so characteristic of the Anadilian family. Of all the noble houses of Tolnedra, the Boruns were most comfortable with the Anadils. Both families were southern, for one thing, and the Anadils usually sided with the Boruns in disputes with the powerful families of the north. Although Anadil was only a duchy, there had never been any hint of subservience in the family's alliances with the Grand Dukes of the House of Borun. Indeed, Andalian dukes more often than not poked gentle fun at their more powerful neighbors. Serious historians and statesmen had long considered it a misfortune for the empire that the talented House of Anadil had not enough wealth to make a serious bid for the imperial throne. When General Varana politely limped into the room where Zinedra impatiently awaited him, there was a faint smile hovering on his lips, and a quizzical lift to one of his eyebrows.
"Your Majesty,"
he greeted her with a bow.
"Uncle Varana,"
the princess exclaimed, flying to embrace him. Varana was not, in fact, her uncle, but she had always thought of him as such.
"What have you gone and done now, my little Tenedra?"
he laughed then, enfolding her in his thick, muscled arms.
"You're turning the world upside down, you know. What is a Barun doing in the middle of Alvaria with an Alon army at her back?"
"I'm going to invade Mishrak Aktul,"
she declared impishly.
"Really? Whatever for? Did King Gethel of Tuldum insult the House of Barun in some way? I hadn't heard about it."
"It's an Alon matter,"
Tenedra replied airily.
"Oh, I see. That explains it, I suppose. Alons don't need reasons for the things that they do."
"You're laughing at me,"
she accused him.
"Of course I am, Tenedra. The Anadels have been laughing at the Boruns for thousands of years."
She pouted then.
"It's very serious, Uncle Varana."
"Naturally it is," he agreed,
gently touching her out-thrust lower lip with one thick finger.
"But that's no reason not to laugh about it."
"You are impossible,"
Tenedra said helplessly, laughing in spite of herself.
"What are you doing here?"
"Observing," he told her. "Generals do that a lot. You've got the only war that's going on just now, so several of us thought that we would drop by and have a look. Morin suggested it."
"My father's chamberlain?"
"I think that's his function, yes."
"Morin would not do that, not on his own."
"Really? What astonishing news."
Tenedra frowned, nibbling absently at a lock of her hair. Varana reached out and took the lock out from between her teeth.
"Morin does not do anything unless my father tells him to,"
Tenedra mused, once again lifting the curl toward her lips. Varana took the lock out of her fingers again.
"Don't do that,"
she told him.
"Why not? That is the way I broke you of sucking your thumb."
"This is different. I am thinking."
"Think with your mouth closed."
"This was my father's idea, wasn't it?"
"I would not presume to say I knew the Emperor's mind," he replied.
"Well, I would. What is that old fox up to?"
"Oh, that's hardly respectful, child."
"You say that you are here to observe?"
He nodded.
"And perhaps make a few suggestions?"
He shrugged.
"If anyone cares to listen. I'm not here officially, you understand. Imperial policy forbids that. Your claim to the Riven Throne is not formally recognized in Tor-Hanath."
She cast a sidelong glance at him through her thick eyelashes.
"These suggestions you might make, if you happen to be near a Tol'Nedrin legion that seemed to need a bit of direction, is it all possible that one of these suggestions might be forward march?"
"That situation might arise, yes," he admitted gravely.
"And you have a number of other officers of the general staff with you?"
"I think I have several of them. In fact, they serve occasionally on that body."
His eyes were twinkling with suppressed mirth. Tenedra lifted the lock again, and General Varana took it away from her once more.
"How would you like to meet King Rodar of Thrasnia?"
she asked him.
"I would be honored to meet His Majesty."
"Why don't we go see him, then?"
"Why don't we?"
"Oh, I love you, Uncle,"
she laughed again, throwing her arms about him. They found King Hrodar in conference with the other leaders of the army in a large airy chamber King Khohag had set aside for their use.
There was no longer any pretense of formality among the leaders of the army, and most of them sprawled in comfortable horsehide chairs, watching as the crimson-robed Hrodar measured off distances with a piece of string on a large map that covered one entire wall.
"It doesn't really seem all that far to me," he was saying to King Kohag. "That is because your map is flat, Rodar," Kohag replied. "The country is very hilly through here. Believe me, it will take 3 days."
King Rodar made an indelicate sound of disgust.
"Oh, I guess we'll have to give up the idea, then. I'd like to burn out those forts, but I am not going to start ordering suicide missions. 3 days' ride is just too far."
"Your Majesty?"
Tenedra said politely.
"Yes, child."
Rodar was still frowning at the map.
"We would like for you to meet someone."
King Rodar turned.
"Your Majesty," Tenedra said formally, "may I present His Grace the Duke of Anadyl? General Verana, His Majesty, King Rodar of Thrasnia."
The two men bowed politely to each other, their eyes probing, assessing.
"The general's reputation precedes him," King Rodar noted. "But His Majesty's skill as a military man has been kept a secret," Verana replied. "Do you think that satisfies the demands of courtesy?" Rodar asked. "If not, we can both lie a little bit later on about how excruciating polite we were to each other," Verana suggested.
King Rodar flashed him a quick grin.
"All right. What is Tonedra's leading tactician doing in Algaria?"
"Observing, Your Majesty."
"You're going to stick to that story?"
"Naturally. For political reasons. Tonedra must maintain a neutral posture in this affair. I am certain that Thrasnian intelligence has briefed Your Majesty on the realities of the situation. The 5 spies you have in the Imperial Palace are thoroughly professional."
6, actually," King Rodar noted in passing.
General Verana raised one eyebrow.
"I suppose we should have known."
"It changes from time to time," Rodar shrugged. "You know our strategic situation?"
"I have been filled in, yes."
"What is your assessment as an observer?"
"You are in trouble."
"Thanks," Rodar said dryly.
"The numbers dictate that you take a defensive posture."
Rodar shook his head.
"That might work if all we had to worry about was Taurogas and the southern Murgos. But Zakath is leading more troops to Torzalek every day. If we fortify and try to sit tight, only decides to move against us, he will be able to bury us in Malorians by autumn. The key to the whole situation is putting Anhag's fleet into the Sea of the East to stop those troops' ships. We're going to have to gamble a bit in order to pull that off."
Verana studied the map. "If you're going to go down the River Mardu, you will have to neutralize the Turish capital," he said, pointing at Tol Mardu. "It is an island, like Tol Hanath, and it is right in the middle of the river. You'll never get a fleet past it as long as a hostile force holds it. You will have to take that city."
"That had already occurred to us," King Unheg said from where he sprawled in his chair with his ever-present ale cup in his hand. "You know Unheg?" Rodar asked the general. Verana nodded.
"By reputation," he replied. He bowed to King Unheg. "Your Majesty," he said.
"General," Unheg responded, inclining his head.
"If Tol Mardu is heavily defended, it will cost you 1/3 of your army to take it."
"We're going to lure the garrison out," Rodar told him.
How?
"That is going to be up to Khoradulin and me," King Kohag said. "Once we get to the top of the escarpment, the Mimbrate knights are going to move out and crush every city and town in the uplands. And my clansmen will strike down into the farming regions to burn every standing crop. They'll realize that's only a diversion, Your Majesty," Verana pointed out.
"Naturally," Brand agreed in his rumbling voice. But a diversion from what? We don't think they'll fully realize that Tul Mardu is our main objective. We'll try our best to make our depredations as general as possible. The loss of those towns and crops might be acceptable at first, but it won't be long before they will have to take steps to protect them. And you think they'll put a garrison out of Tul Mardu to meet you? That was the idea, King Rodar replied.
Varana shook his head.
They'll bring Maragos up from Rakoska, and Malorians from Torzelek. Then, instead of a quick raid on Tul Mardu, you will have a general war on your hands.
That's what you would do, General Varana, King Rodar disagreed. But you are not Zakath or Tar Argus. Our strategy is based on our assessment of those two men. Neither of them will commit his forces unless he's convinced that we pose a major threat. Each of them wants to save as much of his army as possible. In their view, we are only an incidental annoyance, and an excuse to put an army into the field. For them, the real war starts when they attack each other. Each of them will hold back, and King Dethal of the Tulls will have to meet us on his own with only token support from the Murgos and the Malorians. If we move fast enough, we will have Unheg's fleet into the Sea of the East and all of our troops pulled back to the escarpment before they realize what we are up to. And then? And then Tar Argus will stay in Rakoska, as if his foot were nailed to the floor. King Unheg chuckled then. He'll be in the Sea of the East, drowning Malorians by the shipload, and he will be cheering me on every step of the way.
And Zakath won't dare risk those troops he already has at Tulzelek by moving against us, Brand added. If he loses too many men, Tar Argus will have the upper hand.
General Varana considered it.
A three-way deadlock, then. Three armies in the same region, not one of them willing to move.
The very best kind of war, King Rodar grinned. Nobody gets hurt.
Tactically, your only problem is gauging the severity of your raids before you attack Tul Mardu, Varana noted. They'll have to be serious enough to pull a garrison out of the city, but not so serious as to alarm Zakath or Tar Argus. That is a very fine line to walk, gentlemen.
Rodar noted.
That is why we were so delighted to have Tol Nedra's foremost tactician here to advise us, he said, bowing floridly.
Please, Your Majesty, General Varana interposed, lifting one hand.
Suggest, not advise. An observer can only suggest. The term advice implies partisanship, and that is not in line with the Empire's position of strict neutrality.
Ah, King Rodar replied. He turned to King Kohag.
We must make arrangements for the comfort of the Imperial Suggester and his staff, he declared with a broad grin.
Tinedra watched with secret delight as these two brilliant men began what was obviously going to be a firm friendship.
I leave you gentlemen to your entertainments, she told them. Military discussions give me a headache, so I will rely on you not to get me into trouble.
She curtsied to them with a winsome little smile and withdrew. 2 days later, Raug arrived from Ogoland with the contingent of his leaf-mailed countrymen sent by the Gorum. Taiba, who had hovered silently in the background since the army had arrived at the stronghold, joined Senedra and Lady Polgara to greet the Ogos as the wagons which carried them creaked up the hill toward the main gate. The beautiful Marag woman wore a plain, even severe linen dress, but her violet eyes were glowing. Rulg, his cowled leaf-mail shirt covering his head and shoulders like lizard skin, climbed down from the lead wagon and only perfunctorily answered the greetings of Barak and Mandaralan. His large eyes searched the group gathered at the gate until they found Taiba, and then a kind of tension seemed to go out of him. Without speaking, he walked toward her. Their meeting was silent, and they did not touch, though Tyba's hand moved involuntarily toward him several times. They stood in the golden sunlight with their eyes lost in each other's faces, drawing about them a profound kind of privacy that absolutely ignored the presence of others. Tyba's eyes remained constantly on Relg's face, but there was in them nothing of that vacant, placid adoration that filled Ariana's eyes when she looked at Lalderan. There was rather a question, even a challenge. Relg's answering look was the troubled gaze of a man torn between two overpowering compulsions. Zinedra watched them for a few moments, but was finally forced to avert her eyes. The Ulgos were quartered in dim, cavernous rooms built into the foundations of the stronghold, where Relg could lead his countrymen through the painful process of adjusting their eyes to the light of day, and training them to ignore the unreasoning panic which assailed all Ulgos when they were exposed to the open sky. That evening, another small contingent arrived from the south. Three men, two in white robes and one in filthy rags, appeared at the gate, demanding entrance. The Algars at the gate admitted them immediately, and one guard was sent to Lady Polgara's candlelit apartment to inform her of their arrival.
"You had better bring them here,"
she advised the poor man, who was ashen-faced and trembling.
"They have not been in the company of other men for a very long time, and crowds might make them nervous."
"At once, Lady Polgara,"
the shaking Algar said, bowing. He hesitated for a moment.
"Would he really do that to me?"
he blurted.
"Would who do what to you?"
"The ugly one. He said that he was going to—"
The man stopped suddenly, realizing to whom he was speaking. His face turned red.
"I don't think I should repeat what he said, Lady Polgara, but it was an awful thing to threaten a man with."
"Oh, I believe I know what you mean. It's one of his favorite expressions. I think you're safe. He only says that to get people's attention. I'm not even sure you can do it to somebody and keep him alive at the same time."
"I'll bring them at once, Lady Polgara."
The sorceress turned to look at Zinedra, Adara, and Ariana, who had joined her for supper.
"Ladies," she said gravely, "we are about to have guests. Two of them are the sweetest men in the world, but the third is a bit uncontrolled in his use of language. If you are at all sensitive about such things, you had better leave."
Zinedra, remembering her encounter with the three in the Vale of Aldor, rose immediately.
"Not you, Zinedra," Polgara told her. "You will have to stay, I'm afraid."
Zinedra swallowed hard.
"I really would leave if I were you,"
she advised her friends.
"Is he that bad?"
Adara asked.
"I've heard men swear before." "Not like this one,"
Zinedra warned.
"You've managed to make me very curious,"
Adara smiled.
"I think I will stay." "Don't say that I did not warn you,"
Zinedra murmured. Beltira and Belkira were as saintly as Zinedra remembered them, but the misshapen Beldon was even uglier and nastier. Ariana fled before he had even finished greeting Lady Polgara. Adara turned deathly pale, but bravely kept her seat. Then the hideous little man turned to greet Zinedra with a few raucous questions that made the princess blush to the roots of her hair. Adara prudently withdrew at that point.
"What's wrong with you wenches, Paul?"
Beldon asked innocently, scratching at his matted hair.
"Yeah, they seemed a little vaporish."
"They are well-bred ladies, uncle,"
Polgara replied. "Certain expressions are offensive to their ears."
"Is that all?" he laughed coarsely. "This red-headed one seems a bit less delicate."
"Your remarks offend me as much as they offend my companions, Master Beldon,"
Zinedra retorted stiffly.
"But I don't think I'll be routed by the foul mouthings of an ill-bred hunchback."
"Not bad,"
he complimented her, sprawling uncouthly in a chair.
"But you've got to learn to relax. An insult's got a certain rhythm and flow to it that you haven't quite picked up yet."
"She is very young, uncle,"
Polgara reminded him.
Beldon leered at the princess. "Isn't she, though?"
stop that,
Polgar told him.
We have come to join your expedition, the twins said. Belden feels that you might encounter Grolems and need our help.
Isn't that pathetic? Belden demanded. I still haven't learned to talk straight.
He looked at Polgara.
Is this all the army you've got?
The Kereks will be joining us at the river,
she replied.
You should have talked faster, he told Zenedra. You haven't got nearly enough men. Southern Murgos proliferate like maggots and dead meat. Malorians spawn like blowflies.
We'll explain our strategy to you in good time, Uncle,
Polgara promised him.
We are not going to meet the armies of Angarak head-on. What we are doing here is only diversionary.
He grinned a hideous little grin.
And have given a lot to see your face when you found out that Belgareth had slipped away from you, he said.
I would not dwell on that, Master Belden,
Zenedra advised.
Lady Polgara was not pleased by Belgareth's decision, and it might not be prudent to raise it again.
Oh, I've seen Paul's little tantrums before, he shrugged. Why don't you send somebody out for a pig or a sheep, Paul? I'm hungry.
It is customary to cook it first, Uncle.
He looked puzzled.
What for? He asked.
Chapter 10 3 days later, the army began to move out from the Algar stronghold toward the temporary encampment the Algars had erected on the east bank of the Aldur River. The troops of each nation moved in separate broad columns, trampling a vast track through the knee-high grass. In the center column, the legions of Tonedra, standards raised, marched with parade ground perfection. The appearance of the legions had improved noticeably since the arrival of General Varana and his staff. The mutiny on the plains near Tol Vordu had given Tonedra a large body of men, but no senior officers. And once the danger of surprise inspections was passed, a certain laxity had set in. General Varana had not mentioned the rust spots on the breastplates nor the generally unshaven condition of the troops. His expression of mild disapproval had seemed to be enough. The hard-bitten sergeants who now commanded the legions had taken one look at his face and had immediately taken steps. The rust spots vanished, and shaving regularly once again became popular. There were, to be sure, a few contusions here and there on some freshly shaved faces, mute evidence that the heavy-fisted sergeants had found it necessary to vigorously persuade their troops that the holiday was over. To one side of the legions rode the glittering membrate knights, their vari-colored pennons snapping in the breeze from the upraised forest of their lances. Their faces shone with enthusiasm and little else. Zenedra privately suspected that a large part of their fearsome reputation stemmed from the abysmal lack of anything remotely resembling thought. With only a little encouragement, a force of membrates would cheerfully mount an assault on winter or a changing tide. On the other flank of the marching legions came the green and brown-clad bowmen of Asturia. The placement was quite deliberate. The Asturians were no more blessed with intelligence than their membrate cousins, and it was generally considered prudent to interpose other troops between the two Arendish forces to avoid unpleasantness. Beyond the Asturians marched the grim-faced Ravens, all in gray, and accompanying them were the few Kereks who were not with the fleet, which even now was in the process of being prepared for the portage to the base of the escarpment. Flanking the Membrates marched the Sindarian militiamen in their homemade uniforms, and at the rear of the host, the creaking lines of King Tholrak's supply wagons stretched back to the horizon. The Algar clans, however, did not ride in orderly columns, but rather in little groups and clusters as they drove herds of spare horses and half-wild cattle along the extreme flanks of the host. Zenedra, in her armor, and mounted on her white horse, rode in the company of General Varana. She was trying, without much success, to explain her cause to him.
"My dear child," the general said finally,
I am a Tonedran and a soldier. Neither of those conditions encourages me to accept any kind of mysticism. My primary concerns at this moment have to do with feeding this multitude. Your supply lines stretch all the way back across the mountains and then up through Arendia. That is a very long way, Tenedra.
But King Forak has taken care of that, Uncle,
she told him rather smugly.
All of the time we've been marching, his Sindars have been freighting supplies along the Great North Road to Aldaford, and then barging them upriver to the camp. There are whole acres of supply dumps waiting for us.
General Varana nodded approvingly.
It appears that Sindars make perfect quartermasters, he observed. Is he bringing weapons as well?
I think they said something about that, Tenedra replied. Arrows, spare lances for the knights, that sort of thing. They seemed to know what they were doing, so I didn't ask too many questions.
That is foolish, Tenedra, Varana said bluntly. When you are running an army, you should know every detail.
But I am not running the army, Uncle. I am leading it. King Rodar is running it.
And what will you do if something happens to him?
Tenedra suddenly went cold.
You are going to war, Tenedra. And people do get killed and injured in wars. You had better start taking an interest in what is going on around you, my little princess. Going off to war with your head wrapped in a pillow is not going to improve your chances of success, you know.
He gave her a very direct look.
Don't chew your fingernails, Tenedra. It makes your hands unsightly.
The encampment at the river was vast, and in the very center stood King Folrak's main supply dump, a virtual city of tents and neatly stacked equipment. A long string of flat-bottom barges were moored to the riverbank, patiently waiting to be unloaded.
Your people have been busy, King Rodar observed to the dumpy-looking Sindarian monarch as they rode along a narrow alleyway between mountainous heaps of canvas-covered produce and stacks of stoutly boxed equipment.
How did you know what to have them bring?
I took notes while we were coming down through Arendia, King Folrak replied. It wasn't too hard to see what we were going to need. Boots, arrows, spare swords, and the like. At present, about all we're bringing in is food. The Algar herds will provide fresh meat, but men get sick on a steady diet of nothing but meat.
You've already got enough food here to feed the army for a year, King Anheg noted.
Folrak shook his head. 45 days, he corrected meticulously. I want 30 days' worth here, and 2 weeks' worth in the forts of the Drasnians that they're building up on top the escarpment. That's our margin of safety. As long as barges replenish our food supplies daily, we'll always have that much on hand. Once you decide what your goals are, the rest is just simple mathematics.
How do you know how much a man's going to eat in one day?
Rodar asked, eyeing the high-piled foodstuffs.
Some days I am hungrier than others.
Folrak shrugged. It averages out. Some eat more, some eat less. But in the end, it all comes out about the same.
Folrak, sometimes you're so practical. You almost make me sick,
Anheg said.
Well, somebody has to be.
Don't you Sindars have any sense of adventure? Don't you ever do something without planning it all out in advance?
Well, not if we can help it, the King of Sindaria replied mildly.
Near the center of the supply dump, a number of large pavilions had been erected for the use of the leaders of the army and their supporting staff. About mid-afternoon, after she had bathed and changed clothes, Princess Tenedra went over to the main tent to see what was happening.
They're anchored about a mile downriver,
Barak was reporting to his cousin.
They've been here for about 4 days now.
Greldik's more or less in charge.
Greldik? Anhig looked surprised. He doesn't have any official position.
He knows the river, Barak shrugged. Over the years he has sailed just about any place where there's water and the chance to make some profit. He tells me that the sailors have been drinking pretty steadily since they anchored. They know what's coming.
Anhag chuckled. We'd better not disappoint them. Rodar, how much longer will it be before your engineers are ready to start lifting my ships up that escarpment?
A week or so, King Rodar replied, looking up from his mid-afternoon snack.
It will be close enough, Anhag concluded. He turned back to Barak.
Tell Greldik that we'll start the potage tomorrow morning, before the sailors have time to sober up.
Tinedra had not fully understood the meaning of the word portage until she arrived the following morning at the riverbank to find the sweating Karaks hauling their ships out of the water and manhandling them along by main strength on wooden rollers. She was appalled at the amount of effort required to move a ship even a few inches. She was not alone in that. Durnik, the smith, took one shocked look at the procedure and immediately went looking for King Anhag.
"Excuse me, Your Honor," he said respectfully. "But isn't this bad for the boats, as well as for the men?"
"Ships," Anhag corrected. "They're called ships, Durnik. A boat is something else."
"Well, whatever you call them. Won't banging them along over those logs spring their seams?"
Anhag shrugged.
"Well, they all leak quite a bit anyway," he replied. "And it has always been done this way."
Durnik quickly saw the futility of trying to talk to the King of Karak. He went instead to Barak, who was rather glumly considering the huge ship his crew had rowed up river to meet him.
"She looks very impressive when she's afloat," the big red-bearded man was saying to his friend, Captain Greldik. "But I think she'll be even more impressive when we have to pick her up and carry her."
"You're the one who wanted the biggest warship afloat," Greldik reminded him with a broad smirk. "You'll have to buy enough ale to float that whale of yours before your crew's drunk enough to try to portage her. Not to mention the fact that it's customary for a captain to join in when the time comes to portage."
"Stupid custom," Barak growled sourly.
"I'd say that you're in for a bad week, Barak."
Greldik's grin grew broader. Durnik took the two seamen aside and began talking earnestly with them, drawing diagrams on the sandy riverbank with a stick. The more he talked, the more interested they became. What emerged from their discussions a day later were a pair of low-slung cradles with a dozen wheels on each side. As the rest of the Karaks jeered, the two ships were carefully slid out of the water onto the cradles and firmly lashed in place. The jeering faded noticeably, however, when the crews of the two ships began trundling their craft across the plain. Hetar, who happened to ride by, watched for a few moments with a puzzled frown.
"Why are you pulling them by hand?" he asked. "When you are in the middle of the largest herd of horses in the world."
Barak's eyes went very wide, and then an almost reverent grin dawned on his face. The jeers that had risen as Barak's and Greldik's ships had been maneuvered onto their wheeled carriages turned rather quickly into angry mutterings as the carriages, pulled by teams of Algar horses, rolled effortlessly toward the escarpment past men straining with every ounce of strength to move their ships just a few inches at a time. To raise it all to artistry, Barak and Greldik ordered their men to lounge indolently on the decks of their ships, drinking ale and playing dice. King Anhag stared very hard at his impudently grinning cousin as the big ship rolled past. His expression was profoundly offended.
"That's going too far," he exploded, jerking off his dented crown and throwing it to the ground.
King Rodar put on a perfectly straight face.
"I'd be the first to admit that it's probably not nearly as good as moving them by hand, Anheg. I am sure there are some rather profound philosophical reasons for all of that sweating and grunting and cursing. But it is faster, wouldn't you say? And we really ought to move right along with this.
It's unnatural, Anheg growled, still glaring at the two ships which were already several hundred yards away.
Rodar shrugged. Anything is unnatural the first time you try it.
Well, I'll think about it, Anheg said darkly.
I wouldn't think for too long, Rodar suggested. Your popularity as monarch is going to go downhill with every mile. And Barak's the sort of man who'll parade that contraption of his back and forth in front of your sailors every step of the way to the escarpment.
He would do that, wouldn't he?
Oh, I think you can count on it.
King Anheg sighed bitterly.
Go fetch that unwholesomely clever Sundarian blacksmith, he sourly instructed one of his men. Let's get this over with.
Later that day, the leaders of the army gathered again in the main tent for a strategy meeting.
Our biggest problem now is to conceal the size of our forces, King Rodar told them all. Instead of marching everybody to the escarpment all at once, and then milling around at the base of the cliff, it might be better to move the troops in small contingents and have them go directly up to the forts on top as soon as they arrive.
With such a piecemeal approach not unduly delay our progress? King Coradulin asked.
Not that much, Rodar replied. We'll move your knights and Kohag's clansmen up first, so you can start burning cities and crops. That will give the Tulds something to think about, beside how many infantry regiments we are bringing up. We don't want them to start counting noses.
Could we not build false campfires and so on to make it appear that we have more men?
Lalduran suggested brightly.
The whole idea is to make our army appear smaller, not bigger, Brand explained gently in his deep voice. We don't want to alarm Taurogos or Zakath sufficiently to make them commit their forces. It will be an easy campaign if all we have to deal with are King Ganthal's Tulls. If the Murgos and the Malorians intervene, we will be in for a serious fight.
And that's the one thing that we definitely want to avoid, King Rodar added.
Ah, Lalduran said, a bit abashed. I did not think of that.
A slow flush rose in his cheeks.
Lalduran?
Tenedra said, hoping to help him cover his embarrassment.
I think I'd like to go out and visit with the troops for a bit. Would you accompany me?
Ah, but of course, your majesty,
the young Astorian agreed, quickly rising to his feet.
That's not a bad idea, Rodar agreed. Encourage them a bit, Zenedra. They have walked a long way, and their spirits may be sagging.
Lalduran's cousin, Tarasin, dressed in his customary black doublet and hose, also rose to his feet.
I'll go along, if I may, he said.
He grinned rather impudently at King Coradulin.
Astorians are good plotters, but rather poor strategists, so I probably would not be able to add much to this discussion.
The king of Arindia smiled at the young man's remark.
Thou art pert, young Torosin. But methinks thou art not so fervent an enemy of the crown of Arindia as thou dost pretend.
Torosin bowed extravagantly, still grinning. Once they were outside the tent, he turned to Lalduran.
I could almost learn to like that man, if it were not for all of those these and thous, he declared. It's not so bad, once you get used to it,
Lalduran replied. Torosin laughed.
If I had someone as pretty as Lady Ariana for a friend, she could thee me and thou me all that she wanted, he said.
He looked archly at Tenedra.
Which troops did you wish to encourage, your majesty? He bantered. Let's visit your Astorian countrymen, she decided. I don't think I'd care to take you two into the Mimbrate camp, unless your swords had been taken away from you and your mouths had been bricked up.
Oh, but don't you trust us?
Leldoran asked.
I know you,
she replied, with a little toss of her head.
Where are the Asturians encamped?
Oh, that way,
Torrison answered, pointing toward the south end of the supply dump. Smells of cooking were carried by the breeze from the Sundarian field kitchens, and the smells reminded the princess of something. Instead of randomly circulating among the Asturian tents, she found herself quite deliberately searching for some specific people. She found Lamer and Detton, the two serfs who had joined her army on the outskirts of Vovachun, finishing their afternoon meal in front of a patched tent. They both looked better fed than they had when she had first seen them, and they were no longer dressed in rags. When they saw her approaching, they scrambled awkwardly to their feet.
"Well, my friends,"
she asked, trying to put them at ease.
"What do you find, army life?"
"We don't have anything to complain about, your ladyship,"
Detton replied respectfully.
"Except for all this walking," Lemire added. "I hadn't realized that the world was this big."
"They gave us boots," Detton told her, holding up one foot so that she could see his boot.
"They were a bit stiff at first, but the blisters have all healed now."
"Are you getting enough to eat?"
Tenedra asked them.
"Plenty," Lemire said. "The Sindars, they even cook it for us. Did you know that there are not any serfs in the kingdom of the Sindars, my lady? Is that not astonishing? It gives a man something to think about."
"He does indeed,"
Detton agreed.
"They grow that food, and everybody always has plenty to eat, clothes to wear, and a house to sleep in. There is not a single serf in the whole of the kingdom."
"I see. They've given your equipment, too,"
the princess said, noting that the two now wore conical leather helmets and stiff leather vests. Lamer nodded and pulled off his helmet.
"He's got steel plates in it to keep a man from getting his brains knocked out," he told her. "They lined us all up as soon as we got here, and gave every man a helmet and these hard leather tunics. They gave us each a spear and a dagger, too," Detton said.
"Have they showed you how to use them?"
Tenedra asked.
"Not yet, your ladyship,"
Detton replied.
"We've been concentrating on learning how to shoot arrows."
Tenedra turned to her companions.
"Could you see that somebody takes care of that?"
she asked.
"I want to be sure that everyone knows how to defend himself, at least."
"Is it that, your majesty?" Leldoran answered.
Not far away, a young serf was seated cross-legged in front of another tent. He lifted a handmade flute to his lips and began to play. Tenedra had heard some of the finest musicians in the world performing at the palace in Tolhanath, but the serf boy's flute caught at her heart and brought tears to her eyes. His melody soared toward the azure sky like an unfettered lark.
"Oh, how exquisite,"
she exclaimed. Lamer nodded.
"I don't know much about the music," he said, "but the boy seems to play well. It is a shame that he is not right in the head."
Tenedra looked at him sharply.
"What do you mean?"
"It comes from a village in the southern part of the forest of Orindia. I am told it is a very poor village and that the lord of the region is very harsh with his serfs. The boy is an orphan, and he was put to watching the cows when he was young. One time one of the cows strayed and the boy was beaten half to death. He cannot talk anymore."
"Do you know his name?"
"Nobody seems to know it," Detton replied. "We take turns looking out for him, making sure that he is fed and has a place to sleep. That's not much else that you can do for him."
A small sound came from Leldoran, and Zinedra was startled to see tears streaming openly down the earnest young man's face. The boy continued his playing, his melody heartbreakingly true, and his eyes sought out Zinedra's and met them with a kind of grave recognition. They did not stay much longer. The princess knew that her rank and position made the two serfs uncomfortable. She had made sure that they were all right, and that her promise to them was being kept, and that was all that really mattered. As Zinedra, Leldrin, and Torasin walked toward the camp of the Sindars, they suddenly heard the sound of squabbling on the other side of a large tent.
"I'll pilot any place I want to," one man was saying belligerently.
"You're blocking the street,"
another man replied. "Street?" the first snorted. "What are you talking about? It's not a town. There aren't any streets."
"Friend,"
the second man explained with exaggerated patience, "we have to bring the wagons through here to get to the main supply dump. Now please move your equipment so we can get through. I still have a lot to do today." "I am not going to take orders from a Sindarian teamster who has found an easy way to avoid the fighting. I am a soldier."
"Really?"
the Sindar replied dryly. "How much fighting have you seen?"
"I'll fight when the time comes."
"It may come quicker than you'd expected if you don't get your gear out of my way. If I have to get down off this wagon to move it myself, it's likely to make me irritable."
"I'm all weak with fright," the soldier retorted sarcastically.
"Are you going to move it?"
"No."
"I tried to warn you, friend," the teamster said in a resigned tone. "You touch my gear and I'll break your head."
"No,
you'll try to break my head."
There was a sudden sound of scuffling and several heavy blows.
"Now, get up. Move your gear like I told you to," the teamster said. "I don't have all day to stand around and arguing with you."
"You hit me when I wasn't looking," the soldier complained.
"Do you want to watch the next one coming, then?"
"All right. Don't get excited. I'm moving it."
"I'm glad we understand each other now."
"Does that sort of thing happen very often?"
Zinedra asked quietly.
Torasin, grinning broadly, nodded.
"Some of your troops feel the need to bluster, Your Majesty. And the Sindarian wagoneers usually don't have the time to listen. Fist fights and street brawling are second nature to those fellows, so their squabbles with the soldiers almost always end up the same way. It's very educational, really."
"Men,"
Zinedra said. In the camp of the Sindars, they met Durnik. With him, there was an oddly matched pair of young men.
"He's a couple of old friends," Durnik said as he introduced them. "Just arrived on the supply barges."
"I think you've met Rundrig, Princess. He was at Falder's farm when we visited there last winter."
Zinedra did, in fact, remember Rundrig. The tall, hulking young man, she recalled, was the one who was going to marry Garion's childhood sweetheart, Zubret. She greeted him warmly, and gently reminded him that they had met before. Rundrig's Arendish background made his mind move rather slowly. His companion, however, was anything but slow. Durnik introduced him as Dorun, another of Garion's boyhood friends. Dorun was a small, wiry young man with a protruding Adam's apple and slightly bulging eyes. After a few moments of shyness, his tongue began to run away with him. It was a bit hard to follow Dorun. His mind flitted from idea to idea, and his mouth raced along breathlessly, trying to keep up.
"It was sort of rough going up in the mountains, Your Ladyship,"
he replied in answer to her question about their trip from Sindaria.
"What with how steep the road was and all, you'd think that as long as the Tolnedrins were building a highway, they'd pick leveler ground. But I seem to be fascinated by straight lines. Only that's not always the easiest way. I wonder why they're like that."
The fact that Zinedra herself was a Tolnedrin seemed not to have registered on Dorun.
"You came along the Great North Road?" she asked him.
"Oh, yes, till we got to a place called Alderford. That's a funny kind of name, though, isn't it? Although it makes sense if you stop and think about it. But that was after we got out in the mountains where the Murgos attacked us. Why, you've never seen such a fight."
Mirkos?
Zinedra asked him sharply, trying to pin down his skittering thoughts. He nodded eagerly.
The man who's in charge of the wagons, why, he's a great big fellow from Muros. I think he said, wasn't it Muros he said he came from, Rundrig? Oh, maybe it was Kamar. Oh, well, I don't know. For some reason, I always get those two mixed up. Now, what was I talking about?
To Mirkos, Durnick supplied hopefully.
Oh, yes. Anyway, man in charge of the wagons said that there'd been a lot of Mirkos in Sindaria before the war. They pretended that they were merchants, you see, but they weren't. They were spies. When the war started, they all went up in the mountains. Now they come out the woods and try to ambush our supply wagons. But we were ready for them, weren't we, Rundrig? Rundrig hit one of the Mirkos with a big stick when the Mirko rode past our wagon. Knocked him clear off his horse. Whack, just like that. Knocked him clean off the horse. I'll bet he was surprised.
Darun laughed a short little laugh, and then his tongue raced off again, describing in jerky, helter-skelter details the trip from Sindaria. Princess Zinedra was strangely touched by her meeting with Geryon's two old friends. She felt, moreover, a tremendous burden of responsibility as she realized that she had reached into almost every life in the West with her campaign. She had separated husbands from their wives and fathers from their children, and she had carried simple men, who had never been further than the next village, 1,000 leagues and more, to fight in a war they probably did not even begin to understand. The next morning, the leaders of the army rode the few remaining leagues to the installations at the base of the escarpment. As they topped a rise, Zinedra reined Noble in sharply, and gaped in open-mouthed astonishment as she saw the eastern escarpment for the first time. It was impossible. Nothing could be so vast. The great black cliff reared itself above them like an enormous wave of rock, frozen and forever marking the boundary between east and west, and seemingly blocking any possibility of ever passing in either direction. It immediately stood as a kind of stark symbol of the division between the two parts of the world, a division that could no more be resolved than that enormous cliff could be leveled. As they rode closer, Zinedra noted a great deal of bustling activity both at the foot of the escarpment and along its upper rim. Great hawsers stretched down from overhead, and Zinedra saw elaborately intertwined pulleys along the foot of the huge cliffs.
"Why are the pulleys at the bottom?" King Anheg demanded suspiciously.
King Rodar shrugged.
"Who should I know? I am not an engineer." "All right, if you're going to be that way about it, I'm not going to let your people touch a single one of my ships until somebody tells me why the pulleys are down here instead of up there."
King Rodar sighed and beckoned to an engineer who was meticulously greasing a huge pulley block.
"Have you got a sketch of the rigging, Andy?"
the portly monarch asked the grease-spattered workman. The engineer nodded, pulled a rolled sheet of grimy parchment out from under his tunic, and handed it to his king. Rodar glanced at it and handed it to Anheg. Anheg stared at the complex drawing, struggling to trace out which line went where, and, more importantly, why it went there.
"I can't read this," he complained. "Neither can I," Rodar told him pleasantly. "But you wanted to know why the pulleys are down here instead of up there. The drawing tells you why." "But I can't read it." "That is not my fault."
Not far away, a cheer went up as a boulder half the size of a house and entwined in a nest of ropes rose majestically up the face of the cliff to the accompaniment of a vast creaking of hawsers.
"You will have to admit that that's very impressive, Anheg," Rodar said. "Particularly, would you know that the entire rock is being lifted by those 8 horses over there, with the help of that counterweight, of course."
He pointed at another block of stone which was just as majestically coming down from the top of the escarpment. Anheg squinted at the 2 rocks.
"Darnik," he said over his shoulder,